You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tōki ingoa, nō mai, haere mai, ki te wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 14th of September. My name is Jemima, and I'm your host, as per usual. This is my normal wire, so I would normally be here, and Joe has been producing from home today. I have been looking after The Wire for the last... 4 weeks every day. So, but this is the one I would normally be on. So you've just got me as per usual. We have some cool things coming up on the show for you today. Ifai Akine, I speak to Dr. Diane Sikapautonu from the University of Otago, Wellington, about the government's alert level announcement yesterday and the progress of the vaccination rollout for Pacific and Māori communities. Joe talks to Douglas Aleph on his research surrounding reducing greenhouse gas emissions. I chat to Joshua Levy, who is the vaccination team leader at Bargain Chemist in Manukau, about excess vaccines going to waste. And then this week on Tomorrow's World, Isla and Stella look into how intermittent isolation could be affecting young Kiwis. And finally, Joe talks about the toll digital work culture has on teachers during the COVID-19 pandemic. So some good things coming up for you to listen to. He aho ofakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of the pieces. So tuku pātui mai, you can send me through a text, 5395 is the number, or wai mai rānei, give me a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, koe e wari wari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō he pakihiri roki roki mā runga i te pae tuku tuku o Irarangi Pōho, me haere ki 95 BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website, 95BFM.com. If you head to the BCasts page, that's where you'll find all the awesome work that the news team has been producing, and also the wider BFM family who've been producing some awesome lockdown bits and pieces for you to listen to, because I know it can be, there can be a lot of extra time in lockdown, so do check that out. You can also check us out on our social media, 95BFM News. We're on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram if you want to catch up with things there. If that's easier for you, give us a follow, give us a like, and you can check what the news team is up to on that way as well. Right, let's crack into the show.
Irirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Yesterday, the government announced that Auckland will remain at alert level 4 and the rest of the country at alert level 2 until at least Tuesday, the 21st of September. At 11:59. Alert levels will be reviewed again on Monday, the 20th of September. A common concern circulating at the moment is that New Zealand's vaccination rates are just not high enough to run the risk of a Delta outbreak without a lockdown. People are saying that the vaccination rollout didn't happen fast enough and that vaccination rates need to increase quickly to protect our population and, of course, our vulnerable communities, such as Māori, Pacifica and immunocompromised people. This morning, I spoke with Dr. Diane Sikapautonu, who works at the University of Otago, Wellington, as an immunologist. She's also the head of the Pacific Office and a senior lecturer in pathology and molecular medicine. And I talked to her about her position on the government's alert level announcement yesterday. We also talk about the progress of the vaccination rollout and whether enough support has been given to Pacific and Māori communities. Here is Diane now.
I think this was the right decision at this time, and it was encouraging to know that we'd have another week to get on top of some of the issues that still need to be resolved, and thinking in particular of the need to get more people vaccinated and to do so quickly, and particularly in the Auckland region, and also to ensure that that our testing numbers for COVID-19 have increased as well, in an effort to try and get to the bottom of some of these mystery cases which had been worrying people, or the unlinked cases which may pose problems if they continue to emerge and if they persist over time.
You mentioned keeping vaccination rates going up. A criticism that's been popping up a lot recently is that our vaccination rates simply haven't been high enough. And it feels like, obviously, now that we've got Delta, that pushes on. What is your thoughts on the progress of the vaccine rollout so far?
Oh, look, great question, Jemima. And I do acknowledge that we were slow to get going with the vaccination rollout in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and that the Delta variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus sadly got into our country and into our communities at a time when our vaccination rates were still too low. So in order to get on top of this and to keep everyone safe, we need our vaccination rates to increase, and what has been really encouraging, Jemima, is that in response to repeated calls for Pacific-tailored and Pacific-targeted approaches and support for the vaccination rollout, that the government did respond to this and provide additional funding to help really get that off the ground in a way that has been really pleasing to see. And we've had some amazing examples over the past couple of weeks in particular of some community-driven and Pacific-led, Pacific and Māori-led initiatives and activities and events where Pacific and Māori people have been able to come and with their whānau and get vaccinated. So about a third of the country has had a double dose of the vaccine thus far, but that is still too low. We need to get those numbers right up.
Now, I just wanted to touch on something that you mentioned before and talk a little bit about the support that's been offered for Pacific and Māori communities when it comes to the vaccine rollout. I know you mentioned some funding from the government that has been able to support that, and then also some community initiatives that have taken place to encourage more people within those communities to get vaccinated. How do you feel like that's going? Are enough Pacific and Māori people getting vaccinated at the moment?
I'm so encouraged and really pleased with the activity that has taken place, particularly over the past couple of weeks. And this has been amazing to see our communities come together and for a purpose. And this is one thing that maybe people don't know about our Pacifica peoples, and that is we have the potential to mobilise really well for a particular cause. And it's exactly what we've seen. To be fair, there was actually quite a bit of work that was going on behind the scenes by our Pacific leaders, our Pacific health workforce, our Pacific health providers, community leaders, church leaders, family members, everyone trying to do their part to keep our community safe. There've actually been a number of these Pacifica and Māori led and driven events recently. One in particular was the Golotonga MMT Max Vax event, and that was held in Auckland over 3 days, and they
yes.
vaccinated nearly 4,000 people. And of course there's the Niuean community as well, who've been organising their festival vaccination clinics, and it was just I'm aware also that all the way down in Dunedin that the Pacific Trust down in Otago have also been doing their part to support Māori and Pacifica vaccination rates to increase. And those are just three examples of many. And so it is dearly hoped that we will see more of this type of approach to helping support people to get vaccinated who might not normally be able to have access. So I guess it was important also to have acknowledgement again that an equity focus to healthcare and healthcare delivery here in Aotearoa, New Zealand is very much needed, because for quite a long time we've relied on a quality one-size-fits-all type approach to some of the interventions, etc., that have been delivered. However, we know that these don't work very well for our Pacifica and our Māori communities, in that what's needed is an equity focus, i.e. Doing what needs to be done to achieve the outcomes that are needed. And this means doing things like engaging with our people, engaging with our communities to help build trust, working with our Pacifica workforce, reducing barriers for people to come and access healthcare, and in the COVID context, thinking specifically about the need to get testing and get vaccinated, but also ensuring that all of this work is being resourced and that our Pacifica health workforce in particular is being included at all levels of design, but also implementation for whatever efforts are being pushed.
This time that we've got with the lockdown is the time to make those changes and ensure that those initiatives are being supported, because we don't want vulnerable communities to get left behind when it comes to potentially down the track when vaccination rates are so high that it won't necessarily call for a lockdown.
It has been incredibly encouraging to have the response from the government that was made in this particular context. And also, Jemima, to point out as well to your listeners that, you know, it was known from the outset that our Pacifica and our Māori communities were particularly vulnerable to being disproportionately affected by COVID-19 and therefore did require prioritisation. So even though we're a bit late to get started on this, I think we're getting there, and that is really promising. And sadly, though, what the COVID-19 situation has also done is really highlighted some of those pre-existing inequities in health for Pacifica and Māori that have persisted over decades and over generations. So in terms of moving forward, I'm delighted that the government has responded to the need for Pacifica-tailored and targeted approaches and solutions for our Pacifica communities and families. And Jemima would really like to see this also applied to other health area needs for our Pacifica communities, because there are some other areas as well where for our Pacifica people we do remain overrepresented in adverse health outcomes, and I think especially of diabetes, acute rheumatic fever, rheumatic heart disease, and of course some other conditions as well. So it's been great to have a strong response now to help Pacific vulnerable communities become vaccinated, but also just flagging that there are needs also in other for other health conditions for our vulnerable communities as well.
That was Dr. Diane Sika-Pautonu, and University of Otago Wellington immunologist, speaking about the government's alert level announcement yesterday and the impact of the vaccine rollout on vulnerable communities such as the Māori and Pacifica communities. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima. I'm your host today. Joe is producing safely from home. If you have any thoughts on the pieces I play on the show today, send me through a text. 5395 is the number. We'll be right back after a little break. Here is Paper Planes by MIA.
Stones and weed and bombs, running when we hit Yeah, I got more records than the KGB. So, no funny business. Are you already off?
Māori words, because he waka eke noa.
Nōku te whiwhi. Lucky me, my gang.
In the audience we have Howard Martin.
Oh, what did I miss? Not much. Everyone's just talking about how much they love farmers.
Well, nōku te whiwhi. Looks like I just got electoral debate bingo.
I wish I was a farmer.
Nōku te whiwhi. Lucky me, my gang.
Māori words. Karawhiua. Give it a go.
Staying in your bubble can be tough. If you need help, it is available to you. For support with grief, anxiety, distress or mental well-being, you can use the Need to Talk service to speak with a trained counsellor. Just call or text 1737. It's free and available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Thank you for doing your best to keep Aotearoa safe. Unite against COVID-19.
Crossing now to our snow reporter on the ground in Wanaka. How are the conditions down there, mate?
It's like being inside a snow globe, moments after an epic shake. Pow pow everywhere, yo!
And how's that for skiing?
Skiing? Well, it's all après-ski tonight. Maxing in the hot tub, maybe some Cool Borders 3 and a mulled wine. Then I'll be hot-dogging that night tomorrow.
The 95 BFM Snow Report, giving you the Powder Run Rundown from on the ground in Wanaka, 5:30 every Tuesday on 95 BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. The 95 BFM Snow Report, brought to you by Cadrona and Trouble Cone.
The Wire. Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
You're back on the Tuesday Wire on 95 BFM. Researchers from the University of Auckland have shown how cows can successfully be toilet trained, similar to that of cats and dogs. Lindsay Matthew and Douglas Elif conducted the research project with help from colleagues in Germany. The research explained how toilet training cows could help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and water contamination. In New Zealand, agriculture makes up almost half of the emissions. Joe speaks to one of the researchers, Douglas Elif, on the matter.
Tell me a bit about the research you're doing with cows and how it affects the environment.
Okay, so cow urine is very high in nitrogen. Nitrogen, as it breaks down, produces two serious environmentally damaging substances, which are nitrates, which can get into the water and help to contaminate the water, and also nitrous oxide, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. So if we could capture at least some of the urine that each cow generates, then it would be possible to mitigate some of those effects by getting rid of the nitrogen, by treating it. So what we thought we would do would be to see whether we could train cows to urinate in a particular place, which would make it easier to collect. We did that by reinforcing them, rewarding them with food for doing so. They learned how to do this really quite quickly. So they would, after training for, say, 5 to 10 urinations, they would enter the area where we wanted them to urinate on their own in order to earn the food. So that's what we did, and we think that this, that by doing this, we've demonstrated proof that cows are able to attend to their own urinary reflexes, and they're able to learn to withhold urination until they're in the right place to do it. So we think that could be helpful.
I read that this idea had been in the works for a while, even as far back as 2007, where this topic was discussed during a radio interview.
Well, Lindsay did originally. He was the first person to come up with this idea, and because we've got kind of overlapping but similar expertise, but slightly different, he thought that it would be helpful to bring me into it too, together with some German colleagues, and we got funding from the Volkswagen Foundation in Germany to do the original research, and we're now looking to keep on going with it here.
Some people may read this and think it's a bit far-fetched, yet your research has shown that cows could possibly be trained the same way dogs or cats could be.
Well, we didn't know whether that would prove to be the case, but we found that it did. It was the case. So we weren't sure yet whether this would work. We usually think of cows, peeing all over the place without control. So we wanted to know, have they got control? And the answer proved to be yes, they can. If you train them, they can learn when to urinate and when to withhold urination.
Our dairy industry is responsible for a large portion of our emissions. Is the next step to apply your research in a New Zealand context?
So that would certainly be the next thing that we'd like to do. We need to figure out how we can scale this up to get it to work with large numbers of animals. In order to do that, we'd have to have some way to sense automatically when they're urinating, and also to give them rewards automatically for urinating. We haven't yet developed that, but we don't think it'll be particularly difficult to do. A technical problem rather than scientific problem.
Are there any challenges that come with a project like this? For example, any economical challenges?
Yeah, well, it would certainly cost something to do, to train each individual animal, which is why we need to automate it. But if the government's going to set emission targets that could only be met by reducing herd numbers, then there would be a good economic imperative to do this instead, so that farmers wouldn't have to reduce their herd numbers so much. The biggest technical problem I think we'll have doing it here is that our cows live outside most of the time, whereas in Europe and North America they tend to live in barns most of the time. So we need to understand things like how many toilets we need scattered around our paddocks, how far cows will be willing to walk to get to those. We know that they'll walk some distance, but we don't know what the limits on that would be. Things like that. So problems with scaling it up, and particularly for our outdoor farming context, pastoral farming rather than barn farming. I think that this would be difficult. What we wanted to do was to show that we had a technique that could work, that this was something that cows could learn to do, and we've shown that. What we do with that next will be, well, what we do next, we don't know yet.
Final question. Has lockdown brought any challenges for you and your research?
Well, most of the empirical work, the actual data collecting, had been done before COVID-19 hit. So since then, we've been working on writing out papers. So this stuff is now published in a pretty prestigious journal called Current Biology. And so things like that get done remotely anyway. If anything, it's been difficult holding meetings here to see how we could go on to the next stages. So we've had to do all that remotely, electronically. Not so good as actually meeting people.
Douglas and his team will look to continue progressing their research while, during the lockdown period, as they look for ways to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and water contamination. Thank you so much for producing that one, Joe.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Joshua Levy is the team leader for the COVID-19 vaccination centre at Bargain Chemist in Manukau. Over the last few weeks, Joshua has noticed that a number of excess vaccines have been going to waste at his vaccination centre. With COVID-19 vaccines being needed right across the world, they are somewhat of a precious resource. And Joshua says that at his vaccination centre, they want to avoid letting any vaccines go to waste. To give you an idea of how vaccines can go to waste, Joshua explained to me that at Bargain Chemist, they get generalised vaccine numbers based on the number of bookings they have. The chemist has a booking website, bargainchemist.co.nz, which people can use to book their vaccine directly with them. Based on the number of bookings, they make up the vaccines for the day. However, if people don't show up to their appointment for any reason, the vaccine set out to them will go to waste if there is not a walk-in appointment to cover it. In my interview with Joshua this morning, he speaks about how he thinks we can prevent vaccines from going to waste by encouraging more people to take up walk-in appointments and how the government might set up a database to help people know where vaccines are going spare. I began by asking Joshua to explain his role.
My role at the vaccination centre at Bargain Chemist in Manukau is to essentially help grease the wheels for the vaccination team and get the ball rolling in terms of fluidity when it comes to people getting vaccinated and getting them from when they enter the store until when they leave. So I help all the way from sort of getting the setup of the store okay. I help with getting all of the signage out in the morning, getting all of the... all the rostering up, making sure we have enough staff on duty, as well as making sure all the stock supplies are all filled up, ready for the next day, and how to accommodate for any need that the vaccination team needs to make the day go as smooth as possible.
So you've been seeing a lot of excess vaccines go to waste at your vaccine centre. What does this mean when vaccines go to waste?
For us as a team, it's really frustrating to see vaccines go to any number of vaccines on a daily basis having to go to waste. This is due to people either having bookings and not showing up, or people are very understandably in level 4 not wanting to come out and go to these vaccinations. It basically means that at the end of the day, because the shelf span of these vaccines, once they are made up, is a maximum of 6 hours, at the end of the day, if we have vaccines left over, we have to discard of them in our sharps bins and biohazard bins, because those aren't vaccines we can then use the following day because shelf lifespan is too short. And it's really hard to having to throw these away when we understand that there's still large amounts of people that we need to get vaccinated, not only in Auckland and New Zealand, but also across the world. It's very frustrating to see from an organisational perspective as well.
Now, do you know whether this is a common problem across vaccine centres in Auckland and across the country more widely?
Yeah, so I know of the fact that it is a common problem across Auckland. I can't speak on the fact across New Zealand, but I'm imagining so, just purely because of the fact that people, if they don't show up for the vaccinations and there are excess vaccines that have been already made up into the syringes, there is a mandate for them to have to be thrown away. It's part of health and safety and part of the vaccine health and safety protocol. So I can speak for us 100%, we have to throw them away. And I would 100% imagine that if any other centre has vaccines left over, which I do understand a few of them do at times, that they do have to be thrown away, which is really, really sad to hear.
Yeah, totally. And I know you mentioned as well before the issues with vaccines being a hot commodity and people not having access to them overseas as well. So it is a sad thing to be throwing them away. So how can this be avoided? How can we stop vaccines going to waste? Is there something people can do better, or is there something the government could be doing to support vaccination centres better?
So I think there's two things that this comes down to. One of them is the fact you can't avoid, at the end of the day, having to throw away these vaccinations 100% of the time. But what I think can happen is that I would much rather having vaccinated, say, 200 more walk-ins that day and have to throw away 5 vaccines than have 100 people come in to get vaccinated that day and have to throw away 5 vaccines. So I feel like it's that benefit ratio. And I also think what the government can do is actually have some sort of system up where stores and vaccination centres at the end of the day can say how many vaccines they have available on hand, as well as at these closing times, which then gets published onto a live database, which anyone can access and see how many vaccines are spare left over any one time. So anyone that's wanting to go get a walk-in or is unsure about coming in at these sort of like middle of the day times is able to go onto that website and help. Hopefully that information will be able to reduce the amount we throw away every day as it's a live feed to the community.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do think that perhaps what people get nervous about when it goes to walking in is that they'll turn up and they'll have to wait a really long time, or they'll be turned around. So that would be an awesome thing if people could actually know where those extra vaccines were. Now, just finally, could you explain what the process is to book in for a vaccination at your vaccination centre, or to walk in and get a vaccine as well?
So our vaccination centre has two ways you can get vaccinated. First of all, you can either do a booking and just go to bargainchemos.co.nz and go to the COVID-19 booking page, select Monaco vaccination centre within that drop-down menu, as well as to select the date and time that you would like to get vaccinated. We have, I believe, over 70 times throughout the day, ranging 10-minute increments across all hours of the day that we're open. So there's a time available for everyone in that sense. And all you have to do is show up for your booking when it comes to your booking. And then we'll get you signed in at the front, ask you some screening questions, get you signed in for your vaccination, get you vaccinated, and then you go into that 15-minute observational period. And it's very similar when it comes down to walk-ins as well. When you show up, all you have to do is just say that you're here for a walk-in vaccination. We'll still ask you those same screening questions, and then we'll just get you booked in just like you would for any other booking. So we do recommend that anyone that wants to get vaccinated, if they don't have a booking or don't want to, you know, sign up and do a booking for whatever reason, they're more than welcome just to show up and we'll get you vaccinated straight away.
That was Joshua Levy, who is the team leader for the COVID-19 Vaccination Centre at Bargain Chemist in Manukau, speaking a little bit about excess vaccinations and how those can be avoided. If Manukau is your local and you are looking to get vaccinated, you can go to the website, which I mentioned earlier, but I will repeat again, which is bargainchemist.co.nz, or you can also head in for a walk-in at 72 Cavendish Drive, Manukau City Centre, in Auckland.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Next on the Tuesday Wire, Joe reports on the toll digital work culture has had on teachers during the COVID-19 pandemic.
With the current lockdown we are faced with at the moment, learning has switched to online learning, where teachers are required to engage with students digitally. However, an important aspect of digital learning is the toll it takes in regard to digital work culture. Digital work culture plays a large role in digital learning, however this can sometimes have a toll on teachers, as the pressure of digital learning can often have an effect on teachers' well-being. I got in contact with Stephanie Melville from the Ministry of Education on the issue. She unfortunately was unavailable for an interview, but she did express the importance of well-being in the education workforce. Stephanie says teachers are doing an absolutely fantastic job supporting their students to stay engaged with learning, especially in a very challenging or under very challenging circumstances, and always with their well-being at the centre. Stephanie also points out that there are well-being support services available for educational staff. The Employee Assistance Program does offer counselling services for teachers that are free, either online or over the phone. And if anyone is struggling with mental health issues, you can contact a helpline. You can contact Healthline at 0800 611 116 or the Mental Health Crisis Helpline at 0800 800 717.
Thank you so much for that, Joe. That is a piece he will be following up next week on Tuesday. You're on The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima. I'm your host. If you have any thoughts on the pieces on the show today, please send me through a text. 5395 is the number. We'll be right back after a little musical interlude with the next episode of Tomorrow's World.
Endless parade of time. Who can say what fruits the future will see ripen? We can only keep looking towards
Tomorrow's World with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95BFM.
another week of Level 4 lockdown, Isla and Stella look into how intermittent isolation could be affecting young Kiwis. They chat with Maria Corkin from the University of Auckland about her research on technoference and its influence on child development, executive functioning in kids, and the differences in outcomes depending on input. Here they are now.
Hi, Earthlings.
I'm Isla Christensen.
And I'm Stella Huggins.
Welcome back to another remote version of Tomorrow's World, the Wire segment where we investigate how science and technology relate to the individual and wider society.
Last week, we unpacked the mechanisms of episodic memory, looking at how it's an integrative rather than isolative process.
And this week, as we stared at our screens for another infinite hour, we spared a thought for all the young Kiwis doing life in lockdown and wondered how the past 2 years of intermittent isolation was affecting them.
We're working on the assumption that most of our listeners have, you know, met a child before and are familiar with how rapidly development happens.
Early childhood, in particular, is hugely influential in a lifespan.
In fact, some research groups have made the bold claim that the blueprint of your personality is laid out in these years, which begs the question of how lockdown babies are going to interact with the world once lockdowns aren't a constant part of their lives.
So this week, we had an intriguing chat with Maria Corkin from the University of Auckland about her research surrounding early childhood development and screen exposure.
What I was interested in is looking at the role of media exposure in early childhood development and the influence of parents on their children's screen time and screen use. And I looked at some of the cognitive outcomes, such as executive functions and attention and language. And I also looked at parenting practices that might be related to children's use of screens and also technoference.
Some of Maria's findings concluded that the amount of background TV going on in a kid's environment rather than just amount of screen time was a predictor of executive functioning.
Executive functioning is a set of mental skills that, for me, lockdown has degraded. Things like working memory, flexible thinking, and importantly, self-control.
These skills obviously have huge implications for how we manage ourselves. But thinking about this from a kid's point of view, the time in your life when you're building the connections and how you'll function in the future, you have to wonder how not so great blueprint being laid will change how you interact with the world.
Well, interestingly, we didn't find that the amount of screen time that children had across the preschool years was associated with executive functions. Instead, we found that the amount of time that TV was going in the child's environment was related, and also allowing the child to eat meals in front of TV. So it's kind of coming through that it's more having TV going in the environment that's important for executive functions rather than just examining the amount of screen time.
It's interesting that screen time alone doesn't have poor outcomes for executive functioning.
Maria points out that input matters. It's easy to make the simplistic assumption that screens equals bad, but these findings suggest otherwise. So a passive stream of noise and colours and shapes does have implications for how a child regulates themselves.
But there are types of screen time and ways of going about screen use that don't have these correlations with poor executive functioning in young kids.
In the past, there has been quite a bit of research that has found links between screen time and attention or symptoms of inattention and hyperactivity. But those studies were predominantly done on TV viewing rather than the diet of screen time that children have today. And I think overall, the quality of screen time that children have today is better quality than in the past when it was just passively watching TV. There's lots of opportunities for quite engaging educational activities. It's kind of a different ball game, really, and we might start to get different results as we get more findings on the relationships between screen time today and some of these developmental outcomes. We still found the link between the background screen media, but maybe the relationships are changing a bit with total screen time that children have.
And the work done by this research group didn't find another commonly assumed correlation: hyperactivity and screen use. This could be down to the types of screen usage examined, For example, TV watching versus educational programs, games, and interactive content.
Which reflects an interesting feature of scientific literature, its ability to keep up with real-world scenarios. Papers go through a whole lot of checks, editing, validity examinations, and all the rest of it before they can be published. Sometimes they're even rejected, and months of research is sent back to the drawing board.
Ignoring the personal how that might be for academics, it's important to know about literature.
Maria's comments about the types of screen engagement have me awfully concerned that Cool Maths Games wasn't actually good for my development, despite maths being in the title.
Considering your ability for maths now, I think times table grids may have been more helpful than Fireboy and Watergill, but it's all in the past. If we were doing that in an in-person classroom, imagine how hard it would be to engage kids in a virtual class. Maria talks about how rules and boundaries that parents put in place for kids and screens change in difficult situations.
Lockdown definitely falls into that category.
We did find in one study that when children have had health concerns, that parents allow them to have more screen time. So that's showing that extenuating circumstances can lead parents to kind of relax their roles and expectations on how much screen time their children can have. And so certainly at the moment in COVID lockdowns, those are extenuating circumstances, and you would expect screen time to go up as parents try to cope. I think I would encourage parents to, if they are increasing screen time, to try to look for high quality activities. Also, not to feel bad if your child, you know, you feel like the child needs something to just relax and unwind as well. Occasionally, that's okay.
Maria touches on something really important here and very relevant to New Zealand, that parents with fewer options for entertainment during lockdown shouldn't feel guilty about this.
And it's very likely that this doesn't reflect a bad parenting style, but instead may be an indicator of the time availability of a parent.
And remember, the type of content consumed does matter.
While we've all heard the jokes about staying healthy because your future doctor did their degree over Zoom, lockdowns might not have had such a disastrous effect on younger kids' education.
But I think at this point, schools have been through it a few times. They have some strategies there in place. Some students enjoy learning online and actually prefer it. So I don't think you can make a general statement that all students' learning will be poorer or that there'll be, you know, lasting detrimental effects. It depends on a lot of factors.
Maria has also researched a concept called technoference, which describes real-life interactions being interrupted by someone's attention being on their device. Her research group had novel findings.
She looked at the implications of technoference on relationships between parents and children in relation to development of a kid's language. They found that even when a parent's phone was turned off, if they habitually checked it when it was on, the behaviours carried on.
Parents and anyone really can't just change their behaviours instantly by turning off their phone. But instead, we have to create long-standing habits. And if you're anything like me, this might be a hard behaviour to change because you always feel like there's a phantom notification that you might be missing.
Kind of on alert all of the time. It's unexpected. So it's like you're allocating some cognitive resources to possibility that you might receive an audible notification. What I was concerned about in my research is whether that might impact on the ways that parents interact with their very young children, which is important because parent-child interactions during the preschool years and during infancy are very important for language development and vocabulary development. What we looked at was whether different types of technoference were related to the ways that parents interact with their children. Virtually everybody that a child comes into contact with now probably has a mobile phone, and a lot of them have audible notifications on. There may be very few people that the child encounters who aren't potentially affected by this, and it might mean that their interactions with other people are less optimal than they might otherwise be. Who knows what effects that could potentially have long term?
And so we don't know the long term implications of screen usage on kids in a lot of ways, simply because these kids haven't grown up yet.
In an interview with a three-year-old about how screens are affecting them probably won't yield the results we're after. So all we can do is work off the assumptions that this early research is indicating for us.
Essentially, input matters. Passive TV in the background of a kid's environment has poor outcomes for their future executive functioning, whereas other forms of directed content like educational games or videos, ebooks and the like don't have these associated negative effects.
How we're using screens with kids also matters. Maria recommends co-using, so kids aren't left to their own devices.
Hilarious.
Thanks. Having your phone on silent to reduce the amount of cognitive resource you're giving to the expectation of the off chance someone might contact you helps reduce technoference. This applies to the toddlers in your life, but also everyone else.
So there you have it. As is often the case with scientific research, the relationship between screen usage and cognitive function isn't so cut and dry.
And we'll simply have to wait and see if these factors have the enormous effect on socialising for the lockdown babies that some schools of thought think they will.
In the meantime, all you can really do is mitigate these effects and do your best with what you've got.
We hope you've been devoting your full attention to this segment, not being affected by any technoference or multitasking.
Wait, multitasking is bad now too?
That's a question for another episode.
Oh well. Kia kaha to those in level 4 dealing with endless zooms, and stay critical, Earthlings.
Looks like everything's gonna be all right.
Tomorrow's World with Isla Christensen and Stella Huggins on 95BFM.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the Tuesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to all of you for tuning in and listening to the show today. Really appreciate your thoughts and your texts, so thank you so much. Massive thank you to Joe, Isla and Stella for producing pieces for the show today. Massive effort going out to massive effort from all of the news team. It's incredible seeing work continually being produced by them. So thank you so much. And then a huge thank you to the people who spoke with us for the show today. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon and that you stay tuned into BFM and listen to some more good bits coming your way. Up next is Gins 1-4. Catch you very soon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.